Well, I'm not Pastor Shaw. I'm Pastor Bart or Dad or whoever I am to you. And I want to talk about lost and found today. And Amanda and I had the privilege of working in children's ministry at Calvary for 10 plus years. And you learn a lot about kids when you are with them that much. One thing we learned was that kids lose stuff. Now, have you ever gone to an elementary school toward the end of their year? There are 8-foot tables set out, and there are heaps of things, and the administration is dying for you to take it away from them. If you are an eBayer, you could probably make a killing that way. And how it works is that it's all about the lost and found table. But have you ever considered what does it mean to be lost? Someone put it this way. Something that is lost is not where it's supposed to be, and therefore cannot be integrated into the life of the one to whom it belongs and to whom it is lost. And you're like, what? Okay, well, let me explain. There was a time this week that I had a chance to have lunch with a friend. And so I showed up to Culver's. And, you know, he had placed his order, and that was great. And then I had, you know, visions of my order. And as I was about to place it, I did the whole thing. And she said, you can stick your card into the card reader. I went to my wallet in my front right pocket. And as you can imagine, it's not there. It was not integrated into my life so that it could be used for the purpose that I have for my wallet. The purpose that I had at that point was for the debit card to allow me to have access to the chicken strips. Now, Jesus is going to be talking about lost and found, and it's going to start in Luke chapter 15. You might think of it as story time with Jesus. He tells us a parable in three parts on lost things. And we need to first understand that there's a complaint. Jesus rarely did things by the book. Now, if the book was the Bible, then yes, he did things by the book. But if the book is what everyone thinks you ought to do, he often didn't do things that way. Think of this. His disciples rarely understood him. His family thought he was crazy. And the religious leaders thought he was bad. So much for that kind of peaceful, easy feeling that we sometimes want. And Luke 15, 1-2 describes the complaint that was leveled against him, that most recent problem that he was having to deal with. It says this. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to hear him. In other words, he was drawing a crowd. And the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." That was the complaint. The Pharisees believed that the right thing to do was to separate from impurity, including impure people. The scribes saw themselves as defenders of God's law. So if someone wasn't devoted to the law, they were seen as a threat to their community and culture. They saw people in two categories, you might say, the good and the bad. If someone was good, then you accept them, you befriend them. If someone is bad, then you need to make sure that they know that you don't approve of their lifestyle. But Jesus didn't operate that way. Think of this. He had that time that he called the tax collector, who was not on the top of the popularity list. His name was Levi, later named Matthew, gift of God. And then they had a party, and that party was filled with people that were impure, unclean, undesirable. Later on in Luke 7, Jesus went to the house of a Pharisee. And there was a woman of ill repute, a sinner, that showed up. And she was so moved by the teaching and the demeanor of Jesus that she wiped his feet with her hair. And of course, the man of the house, the Pharisee who had invited him, said in his mind, this man either lacks standards or he lacks discernment. Jesus was getting himself into trouble with the crowd. And so Jesus told a parable. It's interesting that when someone accuses us of something, we often want to either fight, flee, or freeze. But when Jesus was accused, he often told stories. And I think we can learn something there, not to tell stories when people question our character, but this, that we can leave our reputation in God's hands and seek the good. Not long ago, I was reminded of a story of a man at a local church in our area that his pastor happened to know him, and his pastor knew that he had become a man of prayer. And even though he didn't have an official position in the church, he had really grown. And the pastor said, "Would you mentor me?" And the man said, I don't have anything to teach you. You know, you're the pastor." And he says, "No, I really think you do." After 13 years prior, his wife had left him. And for all that time, he had been praying and seeking restoration. And so the pastor said, "During that time, what did you learn?" And he said, "I learned three things. One, there are many things about which I am helpless. Two, I need to leave the outcomes to God. And three, I must leave the timing to God." And Jesus handled his reputation in that way. We're to leave our reputation in God's hands. We're to leave to him how things turn out, and we're to leave to him the timing of how it all works out. So because Jesus left his reputation in God's hands and he didn't react, he didn't argue, he didn't fight, he didn't try to justify himself, he was free to seek the good. And he did it by telling this story. Because Jesus realized his job wasn't to protect his reputation, his job was to glorify God. And he really does this in how he plays this out. So this story, this parable, really has three parts to it. And it's very interesting how it plays out. The first part is about a searching shepherd. It's in Luke 15, 3 to 7. So he told them this parable. "What man of you, having 100 sheep, if he has lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the open country and go after the one that is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and his neighbors, saying to them, 'Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep that was lost.' Just so I tell you, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance." And what he's trying to get at this idea that, of course, you would do this. What man of you, if he had 100 sheep, wouldn't do this? So he's appealing to everybody's common sense. Now, one of the things I think we sometimes do with this particular story is we get a little bit sentimental. And we say, you know, there's 100 sheep, and he's got 99 of them all where he wants, and then one of them strays, and so, you know what, at great risk, he leaves those 99 so he can search for the one. And I'm always thinking, what about the 99? Have you ever left 99 preschoolers to themselves? That's the kind of thing, okay? But he assumes you know something, and that is that shepherds work in teams. So he's like, okay, those 99, they're good. They're safe. You got them. I'm going to go, and I'm going to find that sheep. When they get back, There is relief. There's a smile that creeps across his face. There's joy. It's shared joy, safe and sound. With part one of the story, Jesus lays out this pattern. Lost, found, joy. I want you to fix that in your mind. You got it. Lost, found, joy. Part two. The searching lady. Or what woman, having 10 silver coins, if she loses one coin, does not light a lamp and sweep the house and seek diligently until she finds it? And when she has found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, "Rejoice with me, for I have found the coin that I had lost." Just so I tell you, there is joy before the angels of God over one sinner who repents. Aren't moms the best at finding things? They really are. Well, you might regret that someday. I think it's sort of a supernatural gift, okay? Now, on the other hand, if you're the guy who's lost it and the mom's trying to find it, that can be a dangerous combination, okay? I know this because I remember when I was about 16 or 17 years old, I had a wallet that had $8 in it, and I made the mistake of telling my mom that I had lost it. And she said, "Where is it?" Well, if I knew, I would go get it. No, but what happened was is that I kind of knew where it might have been. It had probably been lost in the boys' locker room. And she said, "You left your wallet? Where?" Now, I want you to understand that this coin that this lady lost was equivalent to a day's wages. So it's not an $8 coin. This is about a $100 coin. Can you imagine what would have happened if I'd have lost $100 in my wallet? That $8 was about the only subject of conversation we had for about 2 weeks. I mean, you know, I'd come home, she wouldn't ask, "How was your day?" She would be like, "Did you find that $8? You know, that kind of thing. So she was tenacious. Eventually, when it was found, there is joy. And this is what Jesus is trying to say again in part two of the story. There is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. Joy. Part three is the searching father. Now, the main subject of each of these stories, which are part of the larger parable, is the searching person. There's first a searching shepherd, then there's a searching woman, and now there's a searching father. I want you to notice how the beginning of this final part of the parable starts, and it says, "There was a man who had two sons." This is about the man. This is about the father. But there's a contrast between the shepherd, the woman, and the father. In the first two parts of this parable, he says, "What man of you wouldn't do this? You would go find that lost sheep. What woman of you wouldn't do this? You would go find your lost coin." But he doesn't say, "Now, which father of you wouldn't do this?" Because actually, this father is highly unusual. He is not like other fathers, and we'll see how this plays out. First, let's look at the heart of the father toward his younger son. In verse 12, it says this, "The younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me.' And he divided his property between them." Now, the word for property is actually in the Greek, bios, which for you science people know that means life. I think it was a seventh grade science teacher. She'd start every class, bios, life, cardio, heart. I don't know why. And she had like three or four other like Latin words or whatever, but that's always stuck with me. Bios means life. And you're like, well, what does that have to do with anything? Well, he's not just talking about property. He's talking about the land is his life. Okay? You know, if you are a farmer or if you know of farmers, I mean, yes, there might be some assets, but where are they all wrapped up? They're wrapped up in the land. So when the younger son comes to his dad and he says, I'd like you to give me my share of my inheritance, what would it have probably cost the dad to actually parcel off, sell some of his land, which is his life? It's his livelihood. He does this. He actually does this, amazingly. He gives him likely a third of the assessed value because the older is entitled to two shares, the younger to one share in that culture. And he just did it. Verse 13, now, not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had, took a journey into a far country, and there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. The money ran out. A famine hit the land, which is equivalent to a recession or a depression in our economy. Jobs were nowhere to be found. This Jewish boy had to hire himself out as a pig farmer. Not exactly the ideal occupation for him. Plus, the farm boss told him, do not eat the pig food. Literally, it came to that. Times were tough. Now, in verse 17, we find what happens next. But when he came to himself, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread? But I perish here with hunger. I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. That was his light bulb moment. What am I doing? He says. Why have I allowed myself to come to this point? And in verse 20, you see what he decides to do. He arose, he came to his father, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, bring quickly the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fattened calf and kill it. And let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. There it is. Lost, found, what?
Joy.
Joy. Now, what's the point? What's the moral to this story? What's the point to this parable? Now, to get the point that Jesus is making, we have to remember where this started. It started with a complaint. In other words, there's a charge that is leveled against Jesus. And the charge is this. You welcome sinners. You eat with them. And this is Jesus' response. Guilty as charged. I am stoked when the lost are found, and so is my Father. Lost, found, joy. Now, what does that mean to us? What's that? How does that affect us? Jesus said when he came, I have come to reveal the Father to you. And this is one of the ways he did this. First of all, he revealed that the Father is patient. With the younger son, his life and reputation might well have been turned upside down. But God is actually patient with our absurd behavior. Often God will give us what we want, but he lets us feel it. Now, to my shame, you know, I remember the time that I was really struggling with allowing my eyeballs to see things that they shouldn't have seen. I was that younger son. And I remember actually telling God, why can't you just be okay with this? Isn't that awful? God was allowing me to get what I wanted in order for me to realize that what I wanted was not what I wanted. You'd say, that is absurd behavior that God allows us to do. It is. We can see God's patience with the younger son, but this parable was primarily directed to older sons, that is, the Pharisees and the scribes. The younger sons, the tax collectors, the sinners, had been coming home. They had been being welcomed and even thrown a party by Jesus. The question is now about the older sons. I think Jesus is teaching with this unusual father that he has two lost sons. I want you to consider this. First of all, both of them were entitled. The younger son said, give me what's coming to me. The older son said, you have never given to me what I believe I should have gotten by you. Let's read it now. Now his older son was in the field, and he came and drew near to the house. And when he did, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf, because he has received him back safe and sound. But he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him. But he answered his father, look, these many years I have served you, and I have never disobeyed your command. Yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, and you killed the fattened calf for him. And the father said to him, son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad. For this, your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. Now, they both struggled with that entitlement. Secondly, neither of them knew the giving heart of the father. The prodigal son didn't know it because he thought that by taking life into his own hands, he knew better how to satisfy his own needs and desires. The older son felt that he had to earn his father's approval and love. He couldn't just simply receive it. Thirdly, not only were they entitled and did not know the heart of their father, but neither of them reflected their father's character. The younger son was selfish. The older son was self-righteous. He believes he's earned it. You know, somebody has once said, grace cannot be earned, but it can be forfeited by an attitude of earning. And the father allows his older son to feel the weight of his legalism. Just as he's allowed his younger son to feel the weight of his selfishness, he now allows his older son to feel the weight of his legalism. What kind of weight? Bitterness, anger, hatred, comparison, contempt, and pride. It is killing him. It is eating this older son alive from the inside out. Now, outwardly, he looks great. I mean, he's the model citizen. But inwardly, he is full of dead men's bones, as Jesus would say. And instead of the father being defensive or accusing when the older son kind of gives it to him, he appeals to him. Now, friends, we have a patient father, don't we? Whether it is our selfishness or our self-righteousness, God pursues us in whatever way we need to be pursued. There's a former Pharisee, an expert in the way of religion, duty, and self-righteousness, Paul, who said it this way. This saying is trustworthy and deserving of full acceptance. Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am chief. That's what he said. And he said, but I received mercy for this reason, that in me as the chief or as the foremost, Jesus Christ might display his perfect patience as an example to those who were to believe in him for eternal life. In other words, Paul's saying, if God would be merciful to me, a person who was so full of myself, my self-righteousness, so much so that I thought I was doing God a favor by persecuting those who were following Jesus. If God would show mercy on me, how much more could he show mercy on anyone else? So wherever we are in our relationship with God today, I pray that we'll give him our yes. He is pursuing us as the Father is pursuing his sons. Now, he's patient. He waits for his younger son to come to the end of himself before he comes home. If he's chasing his prodigal, he might not have been very effective. And he had to wait for the right time and place for that legalism to kind of come to the surface in the heart of his older son. But be sure of this, he is pursuing both of them. He wants them. He is seeking them. And he is seeking us. Secondly, the father is compassionate. Again, this is an unusual dad. Both sons in their own way have disgraced their dad. One by his selfishness, the other by his self-righteousness. But in both cases, the father sees beyond their deeds to their needs. His compassion actually wasn't simply a choice. It was a disposition. And that's what John means later on when he writes in his first epistle, God is love. That's who he is at the depth of his being. And he feels for his kids. And God feels it for us. Recently I had a gal that I know talking to me about a struggle that she was going through. And she just couldn't keep herself together. But you know what she said to me this? She said this, God adores me in my weakness. Isn't that amazing? He sees us in when we're just not together. And he adores us even in that. That is the compassion of the Father. Now that Father, he literally runs to his son. Which again, you know, the patriarch of the family in that day and age did not run. They would not pick up their robe. They would not show their bare skin. They would not be seen running across a countryside, let alone to a son who had disgraced him. And we are often afraid that our sins, our weakness, our failures keep us from the love of God. But actually, the opposite is true. When he sees his children stuck and hurting, his compassion is toward us. He is drawn to our need. He is not repulsed by our deeds. I love Hebrews 4 for this way, for this truth. It says this, since then, we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. In other words, he gets it. He has felt the pressure, the tension, the difficulty. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace so that we might receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Now, many times when we're at our worst, we want to just isolate, or we want to maybe talk to a friend. And that's not wrong to go to solitude. It's not wrong to go to community. But sometimes we avoid our Heavenly Father because we think, I can't go to Him until I am a little bit clear in my head. Because we're afraid of what we're going to get. But He says, I'll tell you what you'll get. Mercy. You'll get grace for what you need. The Father is compassionate. Thirdly, the Father pays the price. Now, some of you are still wondering whatever happened when I ordered my meal at Culver's. So I placed the order. It was like $10. And you're like, that's a lot of money at Culver's for lunch. I know. But I didn't even have ice cream. It would have been $15 if I'd had ice cream. And I thought to myself, okay, I have my phone with me. So I tried my Apple Pay. It was declined. I'm like, this woman thinks I'm a loser, okay? And there was a reason for the decline, doesn't matter. But anyhow, what happened was, is she literally, she's the manager, okay? She like, with a smile on her face, she takes out her like magic badge and she like swipes it and she looks at me and she's like, it's all taken care of. Now, don't you all go there and try to do that. But here's the deal. It was paid in full. It was paid in full. I had no means to pay, but I had a need. I mean, it was lunchtime, guys. And I was hungry. And for us to come home to the Father, a price also had to be paid. You see, the Father, if you read this parable, this Father's paying a price. He really is. The more you get it, he's paying a price. And of course, Jesus is going to clarify what that price is later. He says, you know, the Son of Man did not come to be served. He came to serve, and he came to give. What was he going to give? His life as a ransom for many, as a payment. You know, we have no means to pay. But he made payment for us in a way that provided for us to be able to come home. I'm going to go back to that idea of lost and found. When we're found, we are reintegrated into the purpose of the one to whom we belong. In other words, this goes back into the front right pocket, okay? What are we here for? What does it mean to be home? To be home principally means that we are with God again. We are home with the Father. That the disconnection, the separation is gone, and that we are with Him. We are with Him so that we can know Him. This is the relationship that he wants. He wants us to have a living, vital, communal relationship with himself. He wants us to help him. Like, okay, now you can get back on the tractor. Okay, now you can help to run the operation. We are called into the yoke with Jesus. That is to be in a partnership relationship with him so that our life is sharing in his great kingdom, his dominion. God is doing a beautiful thing in this place. He is doing a beautiful thing in our community, in our families, and he's inviting us into the yoke to share in helping him promote and advance his reign in the lives of people. And we are brought back home so that we might reflect him. And that is that we might share his character. There are three main characters in this beautiful story. One is the younger son. The other is the older son. But the principal character is the father. And the point is ultimately that the younger son and the older son might come home and ultimately grow up to become like their dad. Their dad who, when he sees people in need, he has what? Compassion. And he wants to meet those needs as he can to help them come home as well. We have been welcomed home so that we might welcome others home too. And for those of us who are home, let's remember we do not work hard so that we may be accepted. We get to work hard because we've been accepted. We are freely received into the heart of God. Let's just take a moment now, quietly, to, if you would, to bow your head and close your eyes and just have a time of reflection. I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to just share what God's been teaching me in this text. And I want to ask you, have you come home to the Father? Maybe you know you are the prodigal. Maybe you know that you're the older son. And of course, many of us sort of trade off. What would it take for you to simply say yes to him? He is the giving Father, and all he wants is for you to receive his grace and enter into the party. Receive the opportunity to come into that party and celebrate with him. We're going to now take some time for prayer. Would you join Pastor Mead as he prays?